from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, an hour on power. Stanford business professor, author, and corporate consultant Jeffrey Pfeffer joins us. His book is called Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. It's an hour all about the latest research on how to acquire power, hold on to it, and use it. Jeffrey Pfeffer joins us in studio for the hour, which will include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Power, who gets it and why, and strategies that separate those who acquire it from those who don't. That's the subject of Jeffrey Pfeffer's new book, Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. Professor of Organizational Behavior at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, Jeffrey Pfeffer is author of or co-author of 13 books and has held visiting professorships at Harvard Business School, London Business School, and IESE Business School in Spain. He joins us in studio for the second hour, and good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me in.
Well, we're going to talk about power, and as far as you're concerned, it's all about, being politically savvy and carving out a career and success or managerial performance, all those kinds of things, but not as much as maybe people think about being liked or achieving a great deal.
Well, I think that's right. First of all, you know, performance, people say, you know, performance is going to get you along the road to success. But what people often overlook is that performance has many components. So you think about, for instance, Tina Brown, who was very successful at Vanity Fair and then The New Yorker and now and actually did a pretty good job at Talk Magazine and now with The Daily Beast. None of these enterprises ever made any money. So how do you define performance? Do you define it as readership and advertising growth? Yes, she did well making money. Did not so well. So performance is multidimensional. That's, I think, one issue. And, you know, many people's performance doesn't get recognized or noticed. And you can also, in some sense, do too good a job. There's a woman who I call in the book Glenda, who's a Scottish executive who did a great job turning around factories. And her company was happy to have her go all over the world, very effective in relating to frontline people. But they never saw her as executive material. And so therefore, they were never going to promote her, even though she did a great job turning around, doing all these turnarounds.
Well, in fact, one of the things that you offer in this book is the notion that maybe there are too many people who don't get power or don't succeed and don't climb up the ladder or crawl up the ladder or whatever it might be because they get things done in many instances and think, therefore, that there actually is a reward system where if you get things done and you do things achieving them, that you're supposed to be rewarded and move up. It doesn't work that way necessarily. It's not a just world, in other words.
It is definitely not a just world. And I think the just world issue is something that gets in the way of lots of people. I got an email yesterday, believe it or not, from a woman who had been laid off by a large local employer at the age of 61, was very unhappy, and was very unhappy about my interview in the Mercury News, which ran yesterday, because she said, this isn't how the world ought to work, and what happened to me shouldn't have happened. And I agree with that, and the world doesn't work necessarily the way you want it to. But the way to change it is not, in my opinion, to talk about how things should be, but to go out and make that happen.
So if you follow the rules, you won't necessarily get the rewards. And maybe you need to think of the world as what we used to say, dog eat dog, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. My colleagues at Stanford in economics teach about the principle of self-interest, and the students go and they learn all these classes, and basically the foundation of economics begins with the idea of self-interest and people behave in a self-interested way. And then people arrive in different context, like in an organization, a workplace, profit or a nonprofit, and they think self-interest stopped working, but it doesn't. It's not necessarily dog eat dog, but you certainly, I think, to paraphrase Andy Grove's book about strategy, only the paranoid survive. A certain amount of paranoia is probably healthy.
What about the old idea that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? I mean, power can be very corrupting.
Power is certainly corrupting. There's research done by my colleague Deborah Grunfeld, and Dr. Keltner over at Berkeley, which talk about how when people get power, a lot of their they don't believe they need to follow the rules anymore, and they engage in what's called disinhibited behavior. And you can see this with Bill Clinton in the Oval Office, literally. Quite disinhibited. And you can see, you know, Dennis Kozlowski and all these other folks who got lots of power and believe they had, you know, and if you're in a position of power, one of the things that happens is that people are always trying to curry favor with you. So they're always telling you how smart you are and how wonderful you are. And after a while, it goes to your head and you lose pretty much a sense of perspective. So in that sense, power brings the seeds oftentimes of its own destruction.
Oh, but there are advantages. In fact, there's a study by William Marmot, British civil servants that you reference. You have a lot of research here on power. People are healthier. They live longer lives when they get power and status, it turns out.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, power, I tell people power does three things for you. Number one, you can monetize it, like the Clintons did when they left the White House. They didn't have much money, and a few years later, they had made $107 million through their speaking and investing in book.
Or Giuliani, as you mentioned.
Giuliani, absolutely. So that's one thing. Second thing, you need power to get things done. We can talk about that later. And thirdly, research by Michael Marmot and his colleagues, and this has now been done. These studies go back now to decades, and they're extremely well-done studies. Found an interesting thing, that the higher your rank in the British civil service, and these are all desk jobs, the lower your risk of dying from cardiovascular disease or having a heart attack. So they looked at other factors that might account for that, like exercise or genetics or body mass index. And they found even net of those things that rank mattered. And then they went on and did further research to demonstrate that what it was the control over the conditions of your work. That if you control what you did, and the time and the pace at which you did it, which doesn't mean that you were like cruising along. The people may have given you a lot of work to do, but as long as you could control how you did it and when you did it, you had job control, you in fact live longer. And anybody who's ever been in a stressful place where their boss has been throwing demands at them understands the truth of this.
Talking to Jeffrey Pfeffer, his book is Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. It has a lot to do with leadership capabilities, people who get things done. How much does it have to do with things like charisma and good looks in terms of really getting power, acquiring power?
Well, there is research that shows that if you're taller, you'll probably be more powerful. There's certainly research that shows that physical appearance is related to salary, if that's a measure of power. But you don't necessarily have to be particularly charismatic. And the thing that I would say to your listeners and to you and to anybody is that all of these are – I mean, you can't obviously affect your physical height. But a lot of the things that we associate with personality and charisma are things that can be learned. These are trainable skills. You can learn how to speak with more forcefully. You can learn how to act and with body movements. I mean, that's what goes on in acting classes. So just as actors can learn skills, so can
some people are more wired to those skills, wouldn't you concede?
I certainly there are individual differences, but you know, if you look at the studies of genius in high performance in virtually every domain, ranging from art to science to sports, what matters often is a lot of practice and a lot of good coaching. And so that doesn't mean that individual differences don't exist. They obviously do. But the thing that I think oftentimes swamps those individual differences is your willingness to work at it.
Well, speaking about coaching and learning leadership and learning power rules or principles of power, Jim Collins, who's highly respected for good reasons, author of Good to Great and How the Mighty Fall, is right on the back of your book with a plug. And you kind of say, don't believe these leadership books. In other words, they'll lead you astray. So many of the rules that they claim apply don't necessarily apply because they give it their own spin.
Well, I think the two issues with the leadership books, first of all, they're the autobiographies or semi-autobiographies in which you have to be a little skeptical about how people tell their own story. But more than that, I think the leadership literature has often confused aspirations, which I'm all in favor of, with descriptions of reality. So many of the books that talk about how leaders ought to be are based upon good research and are right about that's how leaders ought to be. But those books don't necessarily describe how leaders are. I don't see any leadership book that describes, for instance, George Steinbrenner and his behavior. He was certainly not a good boss. He was abusive. I wouldn't make excuses for this. But on the other hand, look at what he accomplished. And, you know, Larry Ellison would be probably another example.
Yeah, there are some who say abusive bosses will get more more work out of because of the anger that they incite or because of the juices that they get going? I'm sure you've heard that argument.
Yes. I don't
You don't buy it.
I don't buy it, but I also think it really goes back to this issue that you raised a couple minutes ago about likability. If you are powerful, you control a lot of resources and you get a lot of stuff done, people will come to think much more highly of you. They'll actually come to like you.
Well, you also point out how important it is not only in getting power but in maintaining power to get the support system, the network, to get those behind you who can, in fact, present you in your best way.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think people underestimate is the importance of having a public relations strategy, not just for book authors and not even just for CEOs, but for people early in their career. And I tell the story in the book of a guy from Brazil, Marcelo Miranda, who has built a very effective career in Brazil by reaching out, cultivating the media, writing articles for the press. And, you know, when you get your picture on the cover of the leading Brazilian magazine as part of a story, 10 CEOs of the future, your career is pretty good shape.
So how important overall in terms of acquisition of power is good old-fashioned, I don't call it aggression and drive? I mean, they kind of go together, don't they?
I think you certainly need to have energy because you're going to be competing against people who work very hard and who are willing to put a lot into this. And, you know, at one point we could talk about the trade-offs are required. And one is the amount of time that you have to spend doing all this stuff. So you certainly need drive. You certainly need energy. You certainly need ambition in order to make the sacrifices and the trade-offs that you have to do if you're really going to be successful. So yes, that is very important, and you have to be willing a little to promote yourself and to get out in front and to not try to hide your light under the bushel, as the kind of biblical saying would be.
Well, you also you write about self-handicapping. A lot of people do this. They say early on in the book, you write about a woman you call Beth, and she says, "I'm not going to play the power game," and that's a way of sort of protecting yourself. But this is very common for people to say, "I don't want to play that game," or "I don't want to get involved in that," because, well, they don't necessarily take the initiative or give themselves the self-confidence they need.
That's correct. I mean, you know, one of the ironies is, you know, the self-handicapping literature actually came out of studying for tests. And it turns out if you're about to take a test and you were concerned about your performance on the test, and if you don't study for the test, of course, you will objectively almost certainly do worse. But on the other hand, then you can say, well, the test didn't reflect my real abilities. So you kind of protect your ego because you say, if I had studied, I would have done better. And similarly in power, you could say, well, you know, if I had really tried, I would have probably been powerful, but I chose to opt out. I followed a higher plane, or I was not willing to play the game. And I have no trouble with people who say, this is not a game I want to play. I'm not willing to pay the price. I'm not willing to do what is required. That's not a problem. But if you're going to get onto the football field or whatever sport it is, you need to understand the rules of that game and you need to be willing to play it.
Our guest is Professor Jeffrey Pfeffer. His book is Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. Do you lend any credence to things like the Peter Principle or the Dilbert Principle?
Well, you know, the Peter Principle and the Dilbert Principle basically talk about people getting into positions that they are not qualified to hold. And of course, it depends upon what you mean by qualified to hold them. But I would say by definition, if they've gotten into that job, they've been able to do one thing probably very well.
And you know, the Peter Principle says you rise to the level of your own incompetence.
Yes, you rise to the level of your own incompetence. But, you know, if I actually think that I'm sure people get in over their heads and they rise into positions that they're really not competent to do, but they have one thing for which they are very competent, and that is they're very competent in getting people who put them and keep them in those jobs to want them there. And that, you know, so that's a form of competence.
But they also have to be proactive.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's pretty much a requirement. If you're going to build a power base, you really have to be proactive.
You have to be strategic. And what's interesting, Michael, is people don't have any qualms about saying, you know, KQED needs a strategy and Oracle and Hewlett-Packard, they need a strategy. But they don't use that same reasoning for themselves and say, you are a product very much like a company. You need to think about your competition, just as a company does. You need to think about what your brand is and what your value proposition is, just like any other kind of organization. And you need to think about how you're going to advance yourself in your career.
And you can think about that in ways that make you feel like you're commodifying yourself and you want to recoil. I mean, this is why a lot of people resist it, in fact.
Of course.
But on the other hand, I mean, we're talking about all the positive things that go with power, and those are fairly obvious, I suppose. But there are trade-offs, as you said earlier. And one of them is the more powerful you get, the more you're under public scrutiny.
That's completely correct. As I said in the blog about the Mark Hurd thing, you know, when you're the head of HP, you don't have a private dinner. You and I can go out to dinner. We can go out to dinner with whoever probably we want. Nobody's going to recognize us. Nobody cares. If you make a mistake on your expense account, people are going to forgive you. The higher you go, the less forgiveness you're going to get, and the more you're going to be under visibility all the time. I saw this with my friend Rudy Crewe, who is the New York Schools Chancellor and then ran Miami-Dade County Schools. So he was in Miami-Dade County. The man's divorced. People wanted to write about what kind of car did he drive? Did he bus his own, you know, dishes when he went to a cafeteria? Who was he dating? I mean, not stuff that's job relevant at all. I think there's a quote in the book from Bart Giamatti, the former president of Yale University, who said...
And baseball commissioner.
Yeah, and baseball commissioner as well, who said, I always expected to have my job performance highly scrutinized, but he said, I never thought they were going to talk about how I dressed and, you know, and my fingernails and all kinds of irrelevant stuff. So yes, one of the prices of power is this enormous public visibility and always being on stage.
What other trade-offs? It seems to me one of the trade-offs would be that you have sycophants around you and you can't necessarily see the forest for the trees because they're stroking you.
Yes, certainly another trade-off would be it's hard to know who to trust because everybody's telling you what they think you want to hear. I think another trade-off is how you spend your time. Power, as we've already talked about, or success in any kind of career requires enormous amounts of time and energy. And many people will say to me, Jeffrey, I really don't want to spend that much time working on my job. I'd rather spend time with my loved ones or with my friends. And that is certainly a trade-off that people make.
Is there a path to power? I mean, I know that sounds like, on the face of it, like an absurd question, but to some extent, I kept thinking you were sort of dancing around that question in many respects, that there is maybe a way of finding certain tools, having a toolkit together, and making your way toward power, whatever kind of position you're aiming for.
Well, I teach a course called The Paths to Power, so I would say that there are many paths. I think, you know, and not everybody follows the identical path, and I think people need to, in large measure, find a trajectory and a strategy that fits who they are. I've given my size and physical condition, I would certainly not be very successful playing football or baseball, for that matter, or tennis or many other sports. Other people would probably not necessarily be successful being a Stanford professor. So I think there are many ways to carve out a way to career success, and you need to find a path that fits your particular aptitudes and interests. So one of the things that I always tell people is you need to get a very good self-awareness and self-knowledge. You need to be honest about your strengths and weaknesses, and that's, I think, very hard for people.
You also need, as you've been intimating here, you need, some confidence, strong self-confidence and public speaking abilities and building a reputation and building a network. I mean, there are certain principles that sort of underlie all of what you've been saying.
Absolutely. And the principles are based upon, as you've already alluded to, a lot of research. Yes, you need to make sure that your public image is and your internal organizational image is well constructed. And you certainly need to build an efficient and effective social network. And that, again, goes to one of the issues of trade-offs. People oftentimes like to spend time with their friends and family, naturally. But the problem with your friends and family is that they probably travel pretty much in the same social circles that you do so that they have redundant information. And, you know, it's kind of a joke in my class. The students would come in on Monday morning and I would say to them, how have you spent your weekend? And they say, well, we spent our weekend, you know, with our fellow Stanford colleagues. And I'd say, well, you know, fine. But if you spend all your time with your current friends, how will you ever make new ones? And so you have to really force yourself out of your comfort zone to meet kinds of people who are going to be useful to you and who, you know, and are to bring you into new spheres new sources of knowledge.
I was once a couple of times in conferences for CEOs, and what I discovered was that many of them, and this goes back to something you said a little bit earlier, were particularly concerned about just not having time and not having time to, well, be with loved ones, as you suggested, but also do things that would provide new outlets for them or new ways of learning or just discovering new things. In other words, they felt their lives in most instances were completely circumscribed.
I think that's right. You know, one of the reasons why I've never been a dean or an associate dean or any other kind of academic administrator is my dear friend Jim March, who taught for many years at Stanford, is now emeritus, told me a long time ago, he said, you can have power or you can have autonomy, but you cannot have both. And that's right. And your story, I think, illustrates perfectly the fact that, you know, power comes with the price of, you know, I see friends who become deans, who become CEOs, and suddenly they no longer control their schedule in the same way that I do or perhaps you do.
I didn't aspire to be a dean because I saw it as being pretty powerless. I mean, a lot of meetings and a lot of paper pushing and no reflection on deans who were making impact and doing good jobs and everything. But it seemed to me that it was really circumscribed as far as what could be done, although I've seen deans who can be pretty innovative. There is also, of course, the concern about abusing power. And once people sometimes get in a power position, it really does go to their heads.
It absolutely goes to their heads. And one of the advice I give to people is that you ought to build yourself, and this is true whether you're on your road up or once you've achieved this, you ought to get yourself kind of a little personal board of directors, two or three people who are not working with you or for you for sure, and who are kind of friends and who are willing and able to tell you the truth and who you will listen to. Because I think it is really hard to keep yourself on track and keep yourself centered and grounded when you're, you know, getting flown around and wined and dined and having everybody tell you on a minute-by-minute basis how brilliant you are. And so one way to do that is to have some set of people who you've put together, who you know and like and trust and who aren't competitive with you, who can keep you kind of on track.
Keep you honest and maybe be sounding boards, but what about just keeping yourself humble? I mean, this can be a serious task in itself, can't
it? It's a huge task. And, you know, I think we expect a lot of people, you know, when we pay them the enormous salaries that many CEOs get paid and, you know, they get flown around on corporate jets and everybody's ministering to their every need and whim. There are people, and I know one fellow, Gary Loveman, who's CEO of Harrah's Entertainment, who actually came out of academia before he went to Harrah's, I think who has kept himself pretty well grounded and doesn't take himself too seriously. And there's some other CEOs who I think been able to do this also. But it requires an extraordinary amount of kind of personal character and work because the temptations are all to let it go to your head.
The temptation also is to make your work your life and not necessarily have a life in addition to your work when you get in these power positions.
And it's certainly true on the way up to the power positions as well. And so one of the questions that I think people have to think about is what are you willing to do? And, you know, I can recall my own experience when I was in business school 1,000 years ago. I went to the most useful lecture I ever went to was this guy who said, okay, he said, how many of you want to be CEOs? And every hand went up. And by the end of the talk, very few hands remained because he talked about what are you willing to do? What are the trade-offs are you willing to make in order to get to this position?
Well, let's find out what our listeners have to say about power. Jim Collins calls Jeffrey Fevre's book an indispensable guide to power. Again, it's why some people have it and others don't. You may want to opine on that question in itself or have questions for our guest who, as I said, brings in a great deal of social research on this whole question, and it's a fascinating one. Who gets power? How do they get it? How do they maintain it? And why? And, well, are there certain types that power attracts? That may be a question for the ages as well. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us again, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the signal. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Professor Jeffrey Fevre, who is professor at Stanford and also a corporation consultant and a man who's written and co-written many books. His new one is called Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. And I was just saying off air that some people really disdain power. In fact, you know, Henry Kissinger's saying that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac notwithstanding. There are people who find that they recoil at the whole idea of grasping power or being desirous of power. You have something to say about that?
Well, I understand that position. I think many people find the things that you have to do to get power and to wield it and to hold it distasteful. There's an issue of power and ethics. There's an issue of power and how it stacks up against virtually any moral or religious tradition.
There's also the ends justify the means. There's a Machiavellian notion that power comes often when certain means are exploited or necessary.
Absolutely. Of course, the famous New York Parks Commissioner Robert Moses used to say, if the ends don't justify the means, what does? But the other quote I would give you is from Scoop Nisker, who many years ago, before he became a Buddhist comic, was a newscaster for one of the local rock stations. And he used to end his newscast with a wonderful saying, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. And to me, what that says is, if you don't like the way the world is, don't just, you know, send emails to us, which is fine, and call in, but also, and don't eschew power, but go get power, go get the influence to change the world in a way that you want to make it a better place. And you can't do that from a position without power.
And again, Jeffrey Pfeffer is professor of organizational behavior in the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. And our first caller is Harry. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Dr. Pfeffer, I have a question. I wanted to take you back to your conversation about your students. If we think about organizations as being political entities, what would you tell your students who are leaving college and going into the business sphere about how to recognize the power game, power being played at different levels within an organization, and who and what specifically would you have them focus on in terms of being able to determine who exactly is a power player?
That's a great question. To try to give a quick answer, I think there are many indicators of power. Formal job title is one. Formal job title also often doesn't tell you everything. You might want to look at office location. You might want to look at who's in the center of communication networks. You might want to look at who is speaking to whom, who has the most powerful and influential friends. You might want to look at who has a reputation for being powerful.
Well, Michael Corda said it all depends how people are seated. Well, you can tell power positions in terms of where people are seated or what kind of seats they're in.
Yeah. To some extent, I think that probably helps. I would use as many indicators as possible. And also, I would, I think what I would suggest is that you practice, diagnosing power distributions and figuring out who are the power players is like any other skill. You get better the more you do it.
And we thank you, Harry, for that call. And we'll go to another caller up in Napa. Chris, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. You mentioned a few minutes ago that you cannot have power without autonomy. And I wonder if entrepreneurship is an argument against that, where you have folks that gain power through their entrepreneurial skills, and then they have the autonomy to do and move forward as they wish.
I think there is a trade-off between power and autonomy. Even the entrepreneurs, once you become successful and once you become a big organization, I had the privilege of meeting Larry Page before Google went public, and I'm sure there are days, not probably many, but I'm sure there are some days when Larry Page wants probably those old days when he was just a math major at Stanford back, because again, he's now under, and anybody who reaches that kind of level of position is under an enormous level of scrutiny, and they have a lot of demands on their time.
And stress.
Yeah. And stress that comes from the scrutiny and the demands on their time, and the fact that they're playing for much higher stakes, which doesn't mean that once you have power and the resources that come with power, that gives you obviously a lot of good things and a lot of leverage too.
Let me thank the caller, and on we go to more of your calls. Eve, join us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Krasny. I'm absolutely stunned listening to your guest, who seems to have divorced the notion of power from responsibility. And in this sense, he's incredibly typical of the modern MBA system and, unfortunately, Stanford and the Ivy League business schools. If you haven't seen Charles Ferguson's Inside Job, I strongly recommend it. And I worked in the banking sector myself many years. And I've seen good banks and bad banks. I've seen good CEOs and bad CEOs. But I'll be very frank with you. The notion, as Professor Pfeffer would have it, that you don't get promoted past your level of ability is utterly contrary to everything we've seen going down, not only in the banking sector, but in various American corporations over the last I'd say 20 years. And to look at Angelo Mozilla and say that people don't get promoted past there, or Lloyd Blankfein, or any of what's gone on. And if you don't want to take my word for it, take the word of Eliot Spitzer, who not only was promoted past his own level of competence to the role of governor, but he was responsible as attorney general in New York for attempting to prosecute AIG and many of these other malefactors. And he was constantly stymied by MBAs, whether in the banking sector or MBAs and lawyers who worked at the SEC.
Eve, your phone is breaking up a bit, but I'm deconstructing your remarks to bring up a pretty serious question for Professor Pfeffer, and that is, what about separating morality from power and the notion that morality is somehow, well, not indivisible with power?
Well, you know, I'm not like I try to only talk about what I am an expert in. I'm certainly not a moral philosopher or ethics. We could have a long discussion about ethics. I agree with one thing that your caller talked about, which was that there's obviously been enormous amounts of corporate malfeasance. But to me, you know, I wish I could say that this is all the fault of business schools, and if you got rid of business schools, everything would be better, and if you got rid of the MBA degree, everything would be better. I actually don't think business schools very much, to be candid, shape the corporate dynamic. I think business schools, in large measure, really reflect the ethos of American society, and the ethos of American society is very money oriented. We don't have to, you know, that I think is true. The ethos of American society in today's world is extremely individualistic and extremely self-interested and self-centered. And I'm not necessarily in favor of any of this, but you know, I would not. What I've tried to do in this book is describe the world as it is, and to describe why it is that people get into these high level positions. And this is not necessarily the right people or the best people. But what I would say to the caller is what I said before, which is if you don't like the way the world is, calling into this show is a nice thing to do, and it's interesting, but it won't change anything. At the end of the day, if you're going to change the world, you need to be in a position to actually accomplish that change, so you need to be in a position of power.
Let me thank Eve for her call. If you have as a requirement an MBA business ethics, it doesn't necessarily change, I guess you would say, not only the way the world is, but this kind of greed is good ethos that goes
right
back and continues, unfortunately, to afflict us. Let me get some more callers on here, and we'll go to Denver, Colorado. Peter, join us. Hi.
Hi, Jeff, your friend who used to know Tommy D. I hope you're doing well.
Yes, I...
My comment, and I've enjoyed listening to your comments here, and as I've emailed you, your book is outstanding. A couple of comments, and then I'll hang up from you, please. As you've done all of your research, and as you know, I do a lot of work in consulting, I see a massive change in CEOs as they move from being part of a smaller organization to being part of a Fortune 500. Yeah, certainly Fortune 100 organization. And the biggest challenge I see is that they seem to have an inability to match their talk with their actions related to power. Could you comment on that a little bit, Jeff? And I hope to see you and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right. Well, I think one of the things that people often, or one of the issues that I think people confront, and I think this is true in every walk of life, and it would certainly be true in the executive sphere of life as well, is that as you go forward and as you go higher and as you get into larger and larger organizations, you can think about it as moving up in the major leagues, the competition and the demands on you get much greater. And so I think the most successful executives that I have seen never stop learning. They never stop getting coaching. They never stop reading, and they never stop growing, and they never, in that sense, stop stagnating. So I think this is important for people in all walks of life, and I think it's certainly important for executives as well to not rest on their laurels, to continue to learn, to continue to grow, and to continue to engage in personal development. It's the only way anybody can stay on top of their game. It's, by the way, what professors do also.
And talk show hosts, we hope. The worst thing for anybody in power or anybody in any position, even a powerless one, is complacency.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's the
that's right.
The major enemies creeping complacency. Here's a Tom who says, I'm a CEO, and one of the major downsides of power is the responsibility to others, especially to grow and keep them employed and motivated. Another listener says, has Pfeffer done any research or read research on emotional intelligence in powerful people? My experience is that the more power people have, the lower their emotional intelligence gets. And so it adds great topic.
I think that's probably not quite the case. I mean, there is some research done by Gerald Ferris at Florida State University on the power skills and the skills required to acquire power. And certainly sensitivity to others, the ability to read other human beings and understand what their motives are is very important. And I would think that that's a component of emotional intelligence.
But you would also think that people who are power hungry, I mean, we know what that the significance of that kind of phrase and how it applies to some people, are not exactly strong when it comes to empathy or understanding other people.
Well, but that will get them in their way of achieving power, because if I want power, I need to be able to put myself in the other person's place, just as if I want to be an effective negotiator, I have to be able to understand what your positions and interests are.
Chris, whenever we're talking about power, I think of myself, when the Nobel laureate Isaac Singer once said to me, you want power? You know, Khomeini, that's power. You know? I mean, what we're talking about here is pretty small scale in the grand scheme
that's
of things.
That's correct.
Here's Sandeep, who says, I believe success, the guest is referring to, is our careers or workplaces. Success, as many would argue, also entails success being a good parent, child,
yes,
friend, sibling, etc. Also importantly, being a good citizen. Sometimes the prior success needs come in direct clash with success needs of the latter. What is the best advice to strategize to succeed at both? Also, in his experience, how many people, when they succeed in what they want, actually claim they become happier?
Well, one of the things I say in this book is that power may be related to many things, but I'm not sure that it is related, in fact, to happiness.
No more than money is, really, I bet you.
That's exactly correct. Yeah. I think that's exactly correct. And certainly the last email raises a very important point. And one of the things I say on the very first day of the class is, look, this is about getting power as defined in terms of position. This is not in terms of power in terms of spiritual fulfillment or psychological development or necessarily the kinds of family relationships that she was referring to. And as a matter of fact, we've already talked in this conversation about how the quest for career success oftentimes does get in the way of personal relationships and certainly family, because you can't be two places at once. You can't be working as well as, being home with your family.
Talking to Jeffrey Pfeffer, his book again is Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. And Tim writes, sounds like the guest's thinking is about individual power. This comes across as an unexamined assumption. Is he confusing power with leadership? What about cooperative power? What about whole communities coming together to exert power? To limit the analysis to individual power is to assert the necessity for personal, i.e. exclusive ambition and greed. It appears to exclude successful, effective individuals who are not ambitious for themselves but for larger causes. Does your guest have any insights about democratic power? The power invoked by the phrase "we the people."
That's a great question and a great phrase. If you look at I haven't looked at all of them, but if you look at the career histories of people who I think the writer would think of as invoking collective power, people like Martin Luther King, people like Mahatma Gandhi, these are individuals who built organizations. Don't miss out, the organizations that Martin Luther King was associated with and that Gandhi built are organizations, and therefore, like all organizations, they are hierarchies, which is unfortunately the case. I mean, this idea of democracy is great, and I'm a big fan of democracy, and I've already voted for tomorrow. But the research shows that in task-oriented groups, people actually prefer hierarchy. And even in the informal groups like bridge groups or book club groups or sports groups or informal friendship groups, hierarchy almost invariably emerges, and it emerges in virtually every species.
Also, it's desirous of a kind of iconic figure, too. When you mention King and Gandhi, for example, they're powerful, they're at the top of the pyramid in the hierarchy, but they're also iconic.
Yes, of course.
And another listener, speaking about different fields, this is libraries. This is Fred who writes, unfortunately, in my field of work, which is libraries, those that seek power are frequently those that should not have it. They often lack a fundamental understanding of librarianship, direct poorly, and rather than leading by bold steps, look for compromise and decision by committee. Those that are often the most effective are the middle-level librarians, i.e. heads of department, branch managers, subject specialists, who take the leadership, what leadership says, and make their programs and initiatives appear to actually be what they want. Academia is frequently this way as well. What's with that?
What's with that is what I've already said, which is oftentimes the people in the positions of power aren't necessarily the most qualified or the most competent. And so what I would say to the writer and what I would say to your listeners is, if you have skills and you have insight and you have ethics and morals, bless your heart. Also, you then need power so that you're in a position to actually use that for the good of your organization and for the good of society.
On we go to San Jose. Anne, join us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. This dovetails with what was just said. I am a public servant, and I have been in private industry as well as public, but mostly public. And I'm a very low-end clerical person, but I have an innate ability to convince people of things one way or another. I've been punished. I haven't been promoted. I've experienced financial and personal setbacks because of this, but I just happen to be the kind of person who wants to have things move forward. And I have, in one occasion, with the help of a union, but not always with the help of the union. Sometimes I've just managed through going through the channels, getting to the highest person who has the power and who listens to what I have to say. I've succeeded in some major changes, which nobody knows about except me and the few people who affected those changes, but no rewards, and I feel that the skills that I have used in knowing people, in knowing who to contact, in using my union, in using the contract given, union contract given power, I would not have succeeded with making the important changes that I provided to people.
Yeah, but you've made real changes from the sounds of it, and it brings up the whole question about how maybe you get things done by getting closer to those in power and getting on the good side or the best side of those in power. It doesn't necessarily mean you move up the hierarchy or move up in powers.
No, oftentimes we talk about the power behind the throne. I mean, if you have access to people with power and can influence them, then you can get things done as well.
Yeah, look at Nancy Reagan. I mean,
that's right.
whispering in his ear about making peace with Gorbachev and all. Thank you, Anne. And let me go to more of your calls. From Palo Alto, Catherine joins us. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious as to what is changing with the use of the Internet and how, say, bloggers are getting extremely powerful and swaying people's ideas and making movements. And how is that different from the traditional way that people gain power? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for the question.
I think I think the Internet is certainly distributed a lot of information, and it distributes the ability for people to take action and to get their ideas out. Though of course you still need to get people to pay attention, but it certainly permits ideas to go viral. But I'm talking about power really much more informal structures inside of organizations, both profit and nonprofit and governmental. And while the Internet is certainly a powerful force, it is still the case that most of the resources, or at least a great bulk of the resources, are still controlled by government, by the nonprofit organizations, and by private sector organizations. So if you really want power, you still need to deal kind of with getting yourself in a position or access to someone in a high-level position in one of those traditional organizations.
Also, I'm looking at a couple of emails here. I was thinking about last night seeing George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush over in Arlington, Texas in the World Series game, and thinking about how power sometimes obviously comes through bloodlines. And a couple of listeners observe things along these lines. Here's one listener who says, while individual effort can influence one's future, isn't the whole system largely set by birth and social connections? That may be a bit overly stated. But another listener from Oakland says, I have observed throughout my career widespread incompetence among CEOs in the nonprofit sector. I attribute this to cronyism in hiring, a lack of clear outcome standards, and the executive's control over the information that reaches the board of directors.
Well, I think in both the profit and the nonprofit sector, executives hire people who they like, and they mostly like people who make them feel good about themselves. So, you know, it's very unpopular, and we'll probably get even more unhappiness in at least some part of the listening audience. But managing up and managing your boss, and everybody has a boss. Even when you're the CEO, you have a board of directors. And in a nonprofit organization, you have a board of directors. So everyone has a boss, and the ability to manage that boss and the relationship with the boss to make it a successful one is crucial for both getting and holding on to power.
On we go to Willie. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I like to hear your guest speak to power versus influence. It's just that the word power is associated with greed. And earlier in the interview, something was said about a study saying that people didn't like power. I wonder if that would have changed if the word influence was used. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Willie.
Okay. Well, to me, power is a potential, and influence is power and use. So, you know, you can have power and not use it. When you use it, it becomes influence. But I think Willie's comment or Willie's call, I think, really raises a very interesting issue we have, because I think the topic of power and influence and the idea of people dominating others is raises a lot of emotional issues. People have lots of ways of changing the language to make it either more or less provocative.
Margo is our next caller. Margo, you're on forum. Good morning.
Yes. I just have a question regarding, I'm just wondering about some cultural differences that you discovered in some of the research that you're doing in terms of the whole idea of perhaps face saving and maybe perhaps not saying something that's going to create too much, show you off too much in terms of your colleagues, so you need to kind of be careful about that. I just am curious.
Well, that's a fascinating question. I mean, power works very differently, let's say, immediately, what comes to my mind, in Japan, and,
yes,
you know, organizationally and hierarchical.
Well, that's what everybody says, and that's what I used to believe, and I've heard both in Japan and in some of the Nordic countries this old phrase, you know, the nail that gets sticks up gets hammered down. But as I look at my reading of Japan, and you know, I have examples from Japan and India and China and Brazil and many other countries in this book, I actually have come to decide that there are more similarities than differences in how power works across cultures, and that even in Japan, I mean, you can take Mr. Honda, the late Mr. Honda, Soshiro Honda, who stood out, the founder of Sony, was a very outrageous individual, and oftentimes in these cultures where everybody is blending in, to the extent that you stand out, and of course the way you're going to do it is going to be culturally specific, oftentimes works quite effectively.
Let me thank the caller. And here's Kirk in Redwood City. He says, great discussion. I think some people may be turned off from the word power because it seems self-serving, all corrupting and simply not nice. Yet there's another dimension to power which allows people to empower themselves in an incredibly complicated environment like a corporation, giving them strength and a voice at the table. What are your thoughts on seeking power to better define one's presence or scope in a company as opposed to building a fiefdom or seeking the CEO position?
Well, thanks for that question, because it helps me talk about another thing that I wanted to talk about, which is that I alluded to earlier this idea that power helps you make important social change. So I have a friend and former student, actually, who works at the University of California, San Francisco, by the name of Laura Esserman, who's very prominent in the world of breast cancer.
She's been on the show a number of times.
Yeah. And Laura wants to make amazing and important changes in how women get treated for breast cancer and in cutting down the cycle time so that we can learn and enhance treatments. But in order to do that, she needs not only what she has, plenty of surgical skill, technical skill, she also needs the power to get things done in a large bureaucratic institution. And so Laura,
she's very effective.
Yes. But she's effective because she understands the power rules and how to play them. So if you're going to make things better for women with breast cancer, and if you're going to change how we do drug trials or anything else, you're going to have the power skills that we're talking about. So this is not just about self-serving and self-aggrandizement. It's also about making systemic change. And that requires the influence and power to get that done.
Marilee writes, hi, Michael. Love this show. I used to be a customer executive instructor at IBM. We held annual classes for CEOs and COOs of large public and private organizations. Most of these gentlemen, and there were very few women in these positions, were very powerful, but there were two characteristics I observed as key. One you touched on. They all had an insatiable desire to learn, and of course, since they were in class, they automatically were in that group. But the other one was a sense of humor and playfulness. We used to show silly Muppet coffee break films and had some fun games for learning concepts. Often lower-level individuals would not play, but almost without exception, these CEOs and COOs loved them and really got into them and learned the concept, sometimes to their own embarrassment.
Yes, I think that's a good point. And one of the things I talk about in the book, which is a quote from this show, was when you had Salman Rushdie on, he said, if you can get people to laugh, you can tell them anything.
And we go to Joan in Berkeley. Joan, join us.
Yes. I wonder about the power of education and information of our youth. Now, the word capitalism didn't exist in the time of Adam Smith, but he wrote a book 17 years before The Wealth of Nations, which he considered his masterpiece, and it was called The Theory of Moral Sentiment. And unless you've heard of it, this question isn't going to do any good. But the man, Adam Smith, was very logical and critical, and he laid down a system before The Wealth of Nations came out of what has to exist in order for the society as a whole to succeed. Capitalism is great, but that disparity between the low and the high grows geometrically, and you have to have certain conditions and thoughts about your fellow man, or the whole thing is going to fall apart.
I agree with that, and that's, the idea that inequality is bad for the United States, and for that matter, any society, is an idea that's also been pursued recently by Robert Reich, and he's written a bunch of columns on this, and there's actually a research center at the University of Texas, which has studied inequality and which has published lots of working papers and studies on how bad inequality is, and by the way, also for health.
And Joan, we thank you. Seconds left here. Listener named Dennis says, has your guest read Michael Korda's Power, How to Get It and How to Use It? I alluded to it before when I was talking about places where people were sitting. I wants to know if you agree with Korda's conclusions, because it was used by many managers in the 70s, as this listener points out. He says, I found it creepy, but it did have some unique ideas. Do you know Korda's book?
I know Korda's book. It's been a while since I've read it, so I wouldn't want to.
It's not your Bible.
It's not my Bible. I mean, what I try to do and what I try to distinguish between this book and, for that matter, the 48 Laws of Power, which is also a good one, is to try to explain the logic and the social science behind the ideas.
Well, the book, again, is Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. Jeffrey Pfeffer, good to have you with us this
Thank
hour
you
on
so
Forum.
Much.
And good to have you all, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.